Welcome to Words Matter, a series of informal conversations with people sharing words that matter to them. Whether it's quotes, poems, lyrics, or film clips, words have the power to inspire us, provoke new thoughts, and even change the way we live our lives. I'm your host, Kevin Watson, and I've been interested in how words engage, ignite, and direct our imagination, not only as a coach for the past 17 years, but for as long as I can remember. In each episode, my guests will share words that matter to them, where they've come from, and why they play such an important part in their life. I have three returning guests for you today, starting off with Sarah Hughes, who in episode 3 shared her love of the song Shine by Take That, and how the lyrics really mattered to her. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
This is from Better, the Sugar Babes. This is a start, no falling apart. You have to look it in the face and recognize it's you that makes you stronger in every way. Each day, a brand new play. I'll never hear you say, I won't believe tomorrow. And I think that for out of all of that, the part that say you have to recognize it's you that makes you. And again, it comes back to that fact of looking inward rather than outward. So thinking about each day is a brand new play. I never hear you say you won't believe tomorrow. So that says to me that tomorrow isn't going to be like today. If you look at yourself and you decide that you are what will make a difference to your tomorrow, and that can make you stronger, and tomorrow will be different, and you have to believe that. So that last part, I'll never hear you say, I won't believe tomorrow, because you've become stronger because you've looked into yourself. And and I like the fact that it says you have to look it in the face. Okay, so I imagine that you're imagining whatever your fear is as having a face, and look at it, scrutinize it, you know, look it in the face and recognize it's you that makes you. So it's you are the one who can make the difference.
Cool. And I've taken from that, I just wanted to check your thoughts on this, is the first lyrics that you gave me were about the now, if you like, the getting into the now, stop being hard on yourself and get in the now and notice what's around you and smile. And this one is tended to follow that theme in some ways. It's about you. You might be the fear that you're facing, even, you know, that facing the fear, but also then some future about how you can create, how you can shape your own future. You can shape what happens next. Yeah. Would that be fair?
Yeah, exactly. Recognize it's you that makes you.
Yeah.
You know, so you can shape it, you can change it. And also in trying to help other people, regularly, that I notice that they're looking beyond themselves for the answers, for the help that they need. It's a very passive approach. It assumes that life changes come about because you've been quite opportunistic. You know, you've had opportunities that other people haven't had. And no, actually, you've made choices that other people don't make. You've grasped those opportunities that have come your way. You've seen them for what they are rather than ignoring them. And that's the look it in the face thing, isn't it? You know, looking at those things and saying, I can do this, or I'm going to give it a go. What's the worst that can happen, almost, you know?
It's like the Wizard of Oz, right? All the characters are seeking help from the wizard, and the wizard can't give them the help.
We
have all the resources ourselves, right? If we just notice it. Yeah, it's a rather nice thought. Thanks, Sarah. That concept of choice really does resonate for me. Next, we have Peter Freeth. In episode 1, Peter borders words from Willy Wonka. Peter, what have you got for us today?
It's from a philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, an English philosopher and mathematician. It's very short. It's, ideas won't keep. Something must be done about them.
And what does that mean for you?
For me, it means, well, if we take it literally, if you've got an idea, act on it, do something with it. And, you know, there's lots of ideas I have that I think, oh, that'd be a good idea. I don't do anything about it. But I think if you have an idea, and I think that extends to a plan or a dream aspiration in life, just do something, anything. Because ideas, I think as well, ideas have a time. They come with a time. Our ideas don't come out of nowhere. We're inspired by events around us, most of which we're going to be completely unaware of. You know, the influences that are acting upon us, and all the things we see us around, all the things we see around us in the world, you know, probably for most of us, if we look out of our windows, everything we see is man-made. Even the trees I'm looking at probably didn't get there by themselves. They're probably planted by somebody sometime. And everything around us is created by somebody who had an idea. And if we don't put our ideas into action, then somebody else will. Somebody else will create the world around us. And then we're conforming to what somebody else created, I suppose. That's another thing to take from it, I guess.
Creating your own future, your own world, rather than consuming other people's ideas and thoughts. Would that be fair?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that idea of creating rather than consuming is very interesting. And you see this on social media, people who mostly just post other stuff rather than creating content and, you know, stuff. And, you know, they become messengers rather than creators. And a phrase you've used before, creating and curating. Because also the hardest thing to do when you've had an idea is to cull it and say, actually, I've had an idea, but it's not a good idea. And, you know, to leave some things behind as well, I think, is...
Yeah.
Which I suppose falls into the category of something must be done about them. We must not just play idle daydreams in our heads. Either do something about it or forget about it.
Yeah. So my thought on that, like you, from what I heard there, I probably share... I have lots of ideas, and very few of them come to anything at all, really. And part of me said, well, that's unfair to the idea, you know. Why have I struck that idea off? And some of them are ideas that probably are worth striking off, as you say, culling out. Some of them less so. And I often wonder whether sharing that idea is an action in itself rather than just you putting the idea into action. And that I do, and I feel the idea is not worthy unless it's aired. So there's an airing of the idea. And if I then carry that idea forward, then that's great. But if I don't, at least I've aired it. And if someone else picks it up, that's okay too for me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, yes, putting it into words and sharing that with other people, it evolves beyond the idea that was in your head. Somebody else will pick it up and think, well, that's a half an interesting idea. But if we did this as well and we added this, and then, you know, it kind of snowballs. I think sharing ideas. And I think a lot of people don't. I think a lot of people are conditioned by having to come up with good ideas. And I hear this a lot in organizations I work with, that people are under pressure to come up with good ideas. And they'll say, I've got a good idea. And I'll say to them, no, you haven't. You've got an idea.
Yeah.
You don't know whether it's good or not until after you've put it into practice, measured it, you know. and what happens is people will then hold back if they think their idea isn't good, or if they think it isn't fully formed, or, you know, they've kind of dismissed it in their own minds.
Yeah.
And actually, I remember working with a guy in an engineering company, and he saw himself as very bright, very quick thinker, very knowledgeable, and, you know, good problem solver, as you know, I think most people do. And what would happen is they'd have a production problem, they'd stop the plant, they'd get around the table and talk about it, and somebody would say, what if? And he'd say, no, that won't work. And somebody else would say, that won't work. That was it, end of conversation. And it would take longer then, and all the onus was on it, you know. And I got a sense that people would tune out and say, oh, well, you know, you fix it then. And what I got him to do was shut up And if you have an objection, write it in his notebook rather than say it out loud, because it's probably a valid objection. Hmm. But he hasn't heard the whole idea yet. Hmm. So it's unfair to shut it down at that point. And what happened was, so I've gone to write it down and then ask, that's interesting. Explain to me how that would work.
Hmm.
So somebody would say, what if we, he would say that. And they would say, well, we could, oh no, that won't work because. And they would talk themselves out of it. But now somebody else has heard the half of the idea. And they said, oh, well, hang on. Because if we started and then we did this and then, and they found, I think they cut the time, they cut the downtime in the plant down to about 25% of what it had been.
Wow.
Their problem solving was four times faster when he allowed other people to share half-baked ideas.
Yeah.
And through that collaborative process to, you know, to allow something to emerge that used all of this collective wisdom around the table rather than, you know, putting him in the position of always being the
problem solver. And I find that too, that, you know, an idea that I have when we share it, when I share it with people, tends to build more ideas. It's not, it doesn't do anything to take away from the original idea, but it has a life of its own then and grows exponentially oftentimes into something that can work and can be put into practice and then becomes a good idea through that, the measurement and operation, as it were. So I absolutely believe in that, sharing it out and helping other people to build on the idea rather than close it down is really incredible.
Yeah, and I think if we even use the language good idea, we imply that there are bad ideas.
Yeah.
And then people become their own censors, which is the worst thing.
Yes.
So, you know, and back in the 90s, there was this fashion for brainstorming and getting people to shout out as many uses for a brick as they could. and it's a good, it became a cliche, but it's a good principle that it's just an idea, just put it on the table. We'll worry about whether it's good or bad later.
And people still hesitate, though, don't they? In my experience, they still hesitate because of what you said, that inner judge that stops them saying what they think inside may be a good idea because what other people might see and what other people might say and how other people might judge that idea. And it's a real shame that the ideas must be stifled every day in those kind of sessions, those kind of meetings, because of that. Some really good stuff.
And eventually somebody will say something and, you know, half the other people around the table go, I was going to say that.
Yeah, exactly. How often do you hear that?
Exactly. And what I find in, you know, in the corporate world, often in terms of career progression and sort of visibility and so on, the people who get on are the people, are often the people who are willing to share their ideas. Because the strange paradox is, you know, people censor their ideas because they think it's a bad idea or a stupid idea, not realizing that if it is, it'll be forgotten about in the next 3 seconds. Only the good ideas get remembered.
Yes.
So if you are the person who's generating lots of ideas or willing to speak out a lot, you'll get remembered for participating, you'll get remembered for being visible, you get remembered for contributing, and only your good ideas will get remembered.
There's another layer, I suppose, in what we do in the kind of freelance business that we operate, the way that we work, is that ideas sometimes aren't shared for fear of competition, for fear of someone else taking it up. I have several friends, several colleagues that are very hesitant about sharing with anyone any thoughts, any ideas, even though they probably won't end up doing anything with those thoughts and ideas. They still don't share them, and therefore, in my view anyway, suffer for that. They don't, probably not as expansive in their thinking, their business, as they could be.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think often if you do that, if you have that sort of mindset, you've discovered something or you've created something, and because you don't tell anybody else, you're under the impression that it's unique, and it probably isn't.
Exactly.
Because as I said earlier, ideas come of a time. There was a situation back in, I think it was either late 60s or early 70s. It was a very harsh winter. And all over the country, birds started opening bottles of milk and drinking the cream out the top of the milk. And the behavior spread across the country faster than would have been possible if they were just observing each other. And people were taught, oh, is this some sort of collective consciousness? But it was just an obvious thing to do. Up until that point, there was food elsewhere. The birds didn't need to do it. They didn't need to risk hanging around on people's doorsteps. Suddenly, the environmental conditions changed, and lots of birds all invented that idea at the same time.
Yeah.
Because it was an obvious idea.
Yeah.
And I think, the same thing happens. I see stuff every day on LinkedIn that's, you see a sudden... You'll see a few sort of early leaders, and then you'll see a tidal wave of people sharing fundamentally the same thing.
So there are ideas that I've had, not to suggest I'm anything different than anyone else, but there's ideas that I've had that it's taken a few years for me to see other people start to think about the same thing or do the same thing. Have you had that before?
Yeah,
definitely. An idea that you've had?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And stuff that I've put in books. And what I find is that something will start with an idea. It'll often come from a conversation with somebody or come from working with some clients. And I think that's interesting. So, yeah, that's certainly the case. And I think, we see this in, product design and technology that, things are created out of some necessity or some inspiration, but it's not shared by the masses. And so most people look at it, so that's stupid, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the early, digital assistants, PDAs, Palm Pilots and PDAs, the Apple Newton and stuff like that. It's like it was like an address book, really. It wasn't much. You couldn't really do much more than that. And now everybody's got a smartphone. I think most people wouldn't know what to do without one.
Yeah.
So I think, I think there are ideas that, and you see this with inventors, that they have to persist for many, many years before they get any sort of traction with people, seeing the potential or seeing even just the utility of what they've created. And it's frustrating because then you think, well, why did nobody listen to me when I said that first? But
yeah.
Because that's not the environment. You said, something like, I don't want to say I'm different to anybody else. But of course, you are different to everybody else. But different doesn't automatically mean better.
Yeah, true.
But you are different to everybody else, and celebrate that.
I guess the other people have got to be receptive to the idea. There's a time for the idea, but there's also a time to receive the idea as well as give the idea. In that respect.
Yeah, and I think it's like we were talking earlier about the problem solving in the engineering company. I think there's being receptive to the idea of an idea.
Yeah.
Without worrying about what the idea is.
Thanks, Peter. As ever, you've got me thinking. What responsibility am I taking for the ideas that I have? Next up, Julie Hayward. In episode 2, Julie brought us a lovely poem by Robert Frost called Nothing Gold Can Stay that had very significant meaning to her. Julie, what are you bringing for us today?
It's a very famous quote. You may or may not recognise it. I'll read it to you first. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust, sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat.
There's a vague recollection of it, but I don't know who would have authored it. Who was that from?
So it's Theodore Roosevelt, and it's commonly known as the man in the arena quote.
Ah, okay. Then I have heard that, yeah. But so tell me, why does that one resonate for you?
It's about... Sometimes when you're fearful of maybe engaging in something new, and I've always been terrified of public speaking. So back when I was very young, I think it must have been in either the first or second year of secondary school, because I can see now the gymnasium where we had our assemblies.
Yeah.
And I'd always been considered to be a good reader. You know, I was asked to read out passages in class, and so the head of year asked me if I would read a passage out in assembly. And I thought, oh yeah, I can do that. That's not a problem. So it was printed out on an A4 sheet of paper. And the assembly, and I practiced, and I read it out loud, and I read it to my family members, and I was confident that I would be able to read this quite lengthy passage out in assembly. So there I was, stood on one of the long benches that we used to sit on at the front of the assembly, with probably maybe 300 students stood in front of me, and I just went to pieces. I started to shake and couldn't get my voice under control. My voice was shaking, the paper I was holding was shaking, and it was just awful. And just became this thing then, this massive thing that I carried with me about being fearful of public speaking. And I had been ever since, and still am in a sense. But a few years ago, I came across this quote in a conference. A lady was speaking, and she was talking about, why people sometimes fear things, because they think that people looking on are going to criticise. You know, people are going to think I'm not very good at this, and people are going to think they could do a better job than me. She read out this quote, and I thought, well, yeah, that is right, you know. I should be able to stand up in front of people and not worry about what they are saying or thinking, because I'm in the arena.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so why am I so concerned about what other people might be thinking and doing when I'm up here doing it? And if I fail and it's not as good as I want it to be, well, at least I've tried. And yeah. Those people who are unwilling to put themselves in those situations, really, you know, they shouldn't be able to comment, because they're not in the arena.
Yeah. And interesting, as you're talking, you're saying that you still have that going on a little bit, even though you do it every day virtually in what you do, right?
Yeah, yeah. And when I introduce myself to new student groups, I sometimes feel a little bit of nerves. But once I'm familiar with them, I become more comfortable, and if it's smaller groups. But I still, if I've got to present at a conference or a room full of my peers, it still fills me with fear. And when I start speaking, I can still feel that little shake in my voice as I start, and maybe the hand shaking a little bit. But, you know, I've sort of learned to overcome that. And in a way, this quote helped me, because I think to myself, I'm here, I'm in the arena, I'm doing this, I'm doing the best I can, you know, and if it's not as good as I want it to be, or perhaps doesn't meet expectations, then that's okay.
Yeah, it's a lovely quote and a lovely sentiment. You know, those other people probably aren't judging anyway, but we do build that up as a, you know, they're going to think they're better or whatever. But as you say, you're doing it, you're in the game, and they're not. So, no, I love that.
Yeah, so that was something that I came across about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and it has really sort of helped me to, when these opportunities come up where I probably would have shied away from them previously and gone, oh no, I'm not speaking at that, or I'm not going to deliver anything at that event, has made me think, well, no, you know, as time has gone by and I've practiced more and I've done more of this type of stuff, obviously, yeah, you know, you sort of learn to overcome the fear, and things improve, I suppose, or you feel more confident.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's anyone that exists that doesn't fear that public speaking in some level. There's often I've seen it talk about the difference between excitement and nerves is difficult to distinguish because they are in the same place in our body. They kind of manifest in the same place. So I don't know whether I've ever always been excited or nervous about public speaking, but I do have that. And you've only just made me think it was the seed of that fear for me in a very early public appearance. I had a situation where I was 7 or 8, I think, where I had to do a solo of The Lord Is My Shepherd in front of the Sunday school that I was made to go to when I was at that age by my parents. And I did it. I always remember that I did it, and I'm very quite proud and tell people I did it. but I can't remember the nerves, but I must have been shaken, because that's not something that I'd have wanted to do and loved to do, and would have been my voice. And I do know that many times through my career, you know, the microphone, if I've had to hold a microphone, is the worst thing for me, because I know I'm going to be shaking and shaking and shaking. So I'd much prefer a microphone that's attached if I have to use a microphone, even now. So yeah, I can relate to that. Thanks, Julie. And thanks for putting yourself out there today. That's it. Thanks to all of my guests, Sarah Hughes, Peter Freeth, and Julie Hayward. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. I hope in some way these conversations have inspired you, and I look forward to bringing you more next time on Words Matter.